In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
The Big Story is brought to you by Scotia iTrade. There's a trader in all of us. If you have a smartphone or a smart speaker,
what can I help you with?
Or even just a laptop with a microphone, you've probably got a weird advertising story.
Huh?
You and a friend were talking about a movie and later you found an ad in your email or on your social media offering you a 2-for-1 deal to that very film. Or you messaged your partner to tell them you were almost out of toilet paper and they found it suggested the next time they logged into their Amazon account. We live in a digital age and advertising that actually knows what you need might be invasive, but it's also practical. But what if the same technology that produces those weird little moments could also be used to tell you that instead of picking up milk for your partner at the store, you should actually be at the store looking for a new partner? And then it helpfully offered you discounts on a dating app and a wardrobe refresh. You probably already make enough of your personal information available to tech giants that they could, if they wanted to, predict the outcome of your current relationship. The question is, do they want to? And why would they? And if they offered you an impartial data-driven analysis of your compatibility with your partner, would you take it? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is quite a strange episode of The Big Story. It is called Expiration Dating, and E.J. Dixon, who writes about sex, dating, and technology for outlets from The New York Times to Rolling Stone to Vox, has been assessing just how accurate big data could be at telling you your partner's best before date. So why don't you start by telling me what is relationship prediction technology?
So I don't know if it's, you know, exactly a concrete term, because it's not really like a genre that exists
right
yet. But basically, it's the term that we use to encompass sort of the vast ways that big tech has tried to predict the endings of our relationships.
And how does that work? How do they do that?
It depends. I think that one of the examples that I gave, one of the earliest examples, was Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg sort of has had a demonstrated interest in doing this. It's kind of rooted in the genesis of Facebook. He used to do this for fun. Like, he developed an algorithm where he could predict, like, with 33% certainty or something like that, whether couples would break up. But yeah, I mean, basically, you know, like, using various algorithms, various formulas, I think I cited a study that eHarmony did using voice recognition technology and how, you know, Alexa and Google Home and things like that could use voice recognition technology to sort of predict the ending of a breakup. So yeah, I mean, it really depends on what data set is available.
When you talk to people about this kind of concept in general, what kind of stories do you hear?
That it necessarily has to do with, like, their relationships. But when I was talking about reporting out that story to people, especially my friends who are in advertising and media, like, invariably they would come out with a story like, oh, you know, like, I happened to mention that, you know, I wanted to buy my cat this brand of cat food, and Facebook targeted me with an ad 5 minutes later.
Right.
Or that was very much aligned with, like, the thesis of the piece, like, whether or not companies would use this data and sell it to advertisers who would then target you with a mattress company if you're looking to move out and buy a new mattress, or, you know, a dating app that you should try if you're on the skids, or a box of Kleenex or something. So yeah, I mean, everybody has a story about, like, a creepy way that they think that advertisers have targeted them.
How much of the data that would go into these kind of algorithms are people providing on the regular, just in the course of doing business with social media and these platforms?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the scariest thing about reporting out this story, is that they have all this information. Like, they could do this if they wanted to. That was something that was stressed to me repeatedly by the eHarmony study author, and something that I just sort of, you know, came up as sort of like a haunting recurring theme in my research. Companies have this data at their fingertips. They could do this if they wanted to. The question is, are we as a society ever going to get to the point where we are willing to say, let Alexa, you know, consent to giving Alexa permission to monitor our conversations, or consent to letting Facebook use all of our data. Are we ever going to get to that point where we're sort of culturally okay with this, I think, is ultimately the question that is being asked by the piece.
Right. And that's a conversation we're constantly having, because I remember when we moved into the age of social media and having all these apps on our smartphones, the first question was, well, what are they going to use from that to target us? And of course, everybody has, like you mentioned, the story about them writing an email to someone with a specific brand in it and getting an advertisement for that brand. And the question is, like, do you think we will get over this hump with smart speakers and phones willing to listen to our private conversations the same way we've kind of come to accept all the rest of the data we regularly give away?
My gut instinct is yes, absolutely.
That's such a scary thought.
I mean, it depends how you look at it. Like, if you look at the data, right? I mean, people always complain about privacy, and people always are like, well, I don't want, you know, big tech accessing my data. But if you look at the, you know, if you look at surveys,
yeah,
like, that's not how people are willing to give up a lot more information than they say they are. And even with Facebook, like, recently I've had a lot of friends who are deleting Facebook, but I would say I have just as many friends who say they actually don't really care about, you know, all the bad press that Facebook has gotten. And all the, you know, information that data that Facebook has on their lives, like, they want to, it's so integrated in the fabric of their lives that it just seems a bigger inconvenience to them than the fact that it's, you know, basically intruding on their privacy. So I think that there's definitely more of a conversation now than ever as to how much we are willing to share with tech companies. But do I think that the culture is eventually going to get to a place where we're going to be willing to pretty much share everything? Yes, I do.
Well, how intimate are we willing to get? Because as a relatively lazy person when it comes to my privacy, I'm fine mm-hmm. with getting these targeted ads. It happens. You know, when right. when I write about stuff in Gmail, I expect to get ads for it. But a few weeks ago, I'm going to do my stupid story because you told me everybody gives you theirs. A few weeks ago, me and my wife got into an argument, just a regular, like, married couple argument about time mm-hmm. with the baby or something else. And when it was done, she opened her phone and opened Facebook, and there was a targeted ad for a divorce lawyer. And that felt like an intrusion on an intimate relationship in the way that, say, us discussing dishwasher soap or the fact that the baby doesn't have any diapers and then getting an ad for that does not.
That's interesting. What do you think, I mean, not to turn the tables on you, but what, like, why do you think it felt different to you?
Because it's an emotional conversation, not a practical one, right? Like, it's one thing to say, hey, I'm really interested in, I don't know, the new movie that's coming out. Maybe we should go see it. And then you get an advertisement to go see that movie. Okay, well, that's something that could really help your life. Whereas sending an advertisement for a divorce lawyer to a couple that presumably had been fighting feels judgmental in a way. And that's what fascinated mm-hmm. me about your piece. Do people, or will people, want that kind of judgment, that kind of objective analysis of their relationship? Because that seems insane to me.
Well, I think that the tech company's argument would be, and, you know, they obviously deny that they're doing any of this. I should probably, you know,
right.
just say that. Yeah, they deny that they're doing any of this. But I think that, you know, hypothetically, the tech company's argument would be, you know, that serving you an ad for a divorce lawyer is practical in the same sense that serving you an ad for, you know, baby formula or dishwasher soap is, that, you know, this is just that tech sort of exists as a solution for all of our problems, you know, regardless of whether or not they're emotional or more logistical. You know, I think it's up to you. I think it's pretty yeah. subjective whether or not you agree with that. But yeah, I mean, I remember speaking to somebody from, I think, Match.com, being like, hey, you know, is this something that people are people really willing to cede control of their data completely, you know, hypothetically in the future, if it meant that they could save themselves a lot of heartbreak, for instance, or, you know, find true love. Like, if we had, you know, an algorithm that could perfectly determine compatibility, for instance. And he said yes. He said his hunch is yes. And I'm inclined to agree with that. I think it's sort of a trade-off, right? Like, I think it's very much subjective, but, you know, in terms of what you are willing to make a priority in your life versus what you're not, if that makes any sense. But
totally.
as I said earlier, I think as cultural acceptance increases, that there are certain problems that we're going to ask big tech to solve that we would be really creeped out by as is now.
Up next, what would that look like in sort of everyday dating life?
I think it would look like a Black Mirror episode.
There's a trader in all of us. Direct invest with Scotia iTrade. Become a new client and you could get up to $1,500 cash or 300 free trades when you open and fund a new account. Conditions apply. See ScotiaiTrade.com for details.
At the bottom of it, there are people, programmers, presumably writing these algorithms. So when you were looking into how tech companies could go about this, what do we know in general about how to predict compatibility and long-term success? Because it's not traditionally been machines doing this, right? There is research out there on this.
There's research on relationship outcome. And John Gottman, who's one of sort of the United States' foremost experts on this, has identified, I think, 7 traits that determine relationship outcome. And this is based on, you know, a couple different studies, including one major one, I think, in 1992. But you know, when you look at the findings, they're all pretty much like it's all kind of intuitive. So there are 4 horsemen of the apocalypse per Gottman: criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. And that came from, you know, analyzing couples' conversations in relationship therapy and sort of, you know, using voice recognition to track for these traits. And that's the principle that this eHarmony study from this year said could be eventually applied to home assistants like Google Home or Alexa, that they could use, you know, this research sort of as the basis for using voice recognition technology to predict relationship outcome, essentially.
So they'd be listening into, like, not just the content of your words, but also the tone you're using with your partner.
Yes, that's exactly what they would be doing. They would be listening for things like pitch, tone, that sort of thing.
What other kind of data does that eHarmony study look at, or some of the other studies you've investigated?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of words, one of the things that they looked at was like using me as opposed to like you, like using first person versus second person, which I found really interesting.
Huh, yeah.
Like if you seem really inwardly focused, and you're not focused on your partner, that can be a predictor or that can be correlated. And that's something that, like, you know, when you say it out loud, it's kind of intuitive.
Yeah.
Right. You know, of course, you know, if you're contemptuous of your partner, or you're stonewalling your partner, or you're, you know, using first person in your conversations, that then it makes sense that your relationship probably isn't in a great place. But yeah, just the idea that technology can actually assess these things and that there is a correlation to relationship outcome is pretty wild.
What kind of future does this propose? Like, if you take this to its logical extension, what would that look like in sort of everyday dating life?
I think it would look like a Black Mirror episode.
So, we're both first-timers. Should we check our expiry date?
Yeah, good plan.
Yeah? Hang the DJ is these characters sort of exist in this ecosystem where they have this app that sets them up, and there's a button that you press and it tells them basically how long they're going to be together. And one couple kind of connects on this blind date and they have instant chemistry, but it says they're only going to be together for a few hours.
12 hours.
Yeah, 12 hours.
Okay.
A bit short.
It is a bit short, isn't it?
And they sort of defy the system in order to be together. And it turns out at the end of the episode, this is revealed to be part of like this algorithm for a dating app where they defy the system like 99 times out of 100. So that determines that they're 99% compatible.
So it flips the whole premise of listening to the algorithm on its head.
That's interesting that you would interpret it that way, because I actually didn't interpret it that way.
How did you interpret it?
I interpreted it as the opposite, that it's sort of an endorsement of dating app algorithms and trusting the system, because it sort of zooms out to reveal that this whole episode has been taking place inside of a dating app algorithm. It's a weird sort of like endorsement of rebelling against the system and endorsing the system at the same time. I mean, we've already proven that we're allowing tech to govern our dating lives and who we sleep with to a pretty large degree. It kind of seems like the next natural step that we would, you know, use, say, voice tracking technology to predict the outcome of our relationship.
And, I mean, it's not that different from some of the algorithms you've talked about in your piece. There is always going to be a natural inclination to not listen to what the computer is telling you, right? That, like, would you put yourself in the shoes of somebody that was theoretically using a relationship prediction technology a couple of years from now, and you meet somebody and it tells you, EJ, this person's not right for you. You're going to break up in a week. Would you then break up with them? Because I would try to prove the computer wrong, I think.
I honestly, I have a kid. Like, I haven't been single for, sounds like I'm in the same boat as you. I haven't been single for so long that, like, it's hard for me
to say. It's hard to even comprehend the dating landscape now.
Yeah. I think that I would like to think that I would rebel against that. But, you know, if it was a proven system and a proven algorithm, I would certainly take it into account, I think. I think it would definitely inform, whether or not I followed the advice of the app or not, I think that it would definitely inform the outcome of my relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah, you'd at the very least ask the questions that it raised.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think that I would, yeah, and I think it would ultimately cause a lot of tension.
So this future isn't that far off. Tell me about an app called Stego.
Right. So it uses this proprietary algorithm to sort of determine relationship outcome or the likelihood of whether or not you'll stay together. And the thing about Stego is that you can also outsource that question to other people on the app and to your family and friends.
Oh, God.
And the first time I heard about it, I was like, well, that's kind of a recipe for marital strife, right? Like, regardless of whether or not the algorithm determines that you're incompatible, like, if you're asking that question to your family and friends, like, that inherently means that you don't have trust in your relationship.
Yeah.
And would ultimately, you know, cause a lot of strife to your relationship. But then I thought about it again, and I was like, well, actually, that's really valuable information. Like, that's really valuable data. Like, what you, and I feel like more people would want that data than not. Like, what you, your family and friends' honest opinion about whether or not you'll stay together.
Well, it's something you would source, you know, in person when you're starting a relationship, right?
I don't think most people would. I don't think most people are brave enough to ask that question just baldly. I mean, there are relationships, like, I can think of them, like, in my personal life. Like, I have friends who have been in relationships where people have stood silent for years about whether or not they like their partner, and it's only until they break up that they're like, oh, we hated that guy, or oh, we hated her.
Right.
All along. So, yeah, I mean, it does make it there. It is attractive on some level, and I think it would be to a lot of people as well to sort of use technology in this very pragmatic, very emotionless way to determine the solution to what is ultimately an emotional problem.
EJ Dixon is a writer on sex, relationships, and technology. That was The Big Story, brought to you by Scotia iTrade. You can visit scotiaitrade.com to start direct investing today. And of course, you can visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca to check out some other episodes, or to contact us, which you can also do on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. We have a brand new name, and you will find all of Frequency Podcast Network on social media by the end of the week. In the meantime, we are at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. You can find us and our brother and sister shows there. And of course, all of our podcasts are available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.